Hi, I'm Dave Barnes.
And I'm John McLaughlin.
And welcome to Dadville.
Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome dadding.
It's funny thoughts and deep talks.
So please, enjoy your time here in Dadville and enjoy this episode with...
Russell Moore.
Dadville is sponsored by BetterHelp.
John.
Dave.
Do you have any New Year's resolutions?
I sure do.
Okay.
Although, sometimes I feel like I get a little over ambitious with my resolutions.
How is that?
Well, I just did the math, and all my daily resolutions add up to about 22 hours a day.
Jeez.
So it doesn't give me a whole lot of time for sleep and meals.
That feels a little overzealous. Sometimes I can get a bit overboard with my resolutions, too.
Mm-hmm.
But here's an idea.
Okay.
Maybe in 2024, we could go a little easier on ourselves, right? Whether it's by being more forgiving with our self-expectations, allowing for more rest, or maybe starting therapy. Oh. 2024 can be a year that we focus on some of the things we're already doing right.
I think that sounds great because I think therapy is a great way to focus on the positive and find your strength, right? It is so helpful.
Yeah.
It teaches coping skills, helps you set boundaries, empowers you to be the best version of yourself.
You couldn't be more right, John. And it isn't just for those who experience trauma. It can benefit anyone.
That's right. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Get a break from your thoughts with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Dadville today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Dadville.
How you doing?
Doing well. How are y'all?
Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The background, for those who obviously can't see, which is everybody, what a tremendous amount of books.
I want to say the couple things. I just want to own up to them right off the jump.
Okay.
The amount of books, right? I can see some important pictures back there. Also, we got a collared shirt with a sweater over it and some great looking hair. Cool. Yeah. Salt and pepper there.
Yeah. Hey,
I feel so intimidated.
it's everything John and I need as musicians to be immediately intimidated.
Well, that's the goal.
It's being achieved
on the third second.
Yeah. It's really quick. Thank you. So everybody, we have Russell Moore on with us today. We are thrilled you are here. I've wanted this to happen for a while now. I don't know if you know that, Russ, RM as I call you. About the city of Nashville. We actually have a few mutual friends, you and I. Actually, a lot more than I knew. And I was actually texting with Dadville alum, Andrew Peterson, this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Just like, give me some dirt. And boy, did he
has lots.
This is going to be a tell-all.
he was restrained.
No, we're so excited to have you on. Thanks for being on.
Are you here? You're in Nashville, right?
I'm in Nashville.
You're pretty close to us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
I can feel it, sort of. It's like the force. So, Russ, I love that I'm calling you Russ, and we've never even met before, but it feels warm. There's a warm.
Okay.
The sweater invites a warmness that I'm participating in, which may be unqualified.
I'm going to go with Dr. Moore the whole time.
Okay,
Dave, you go one way, I'll go the other.
No. We'll just.
It's the Johnny Cash mugshot picture behind me.
It is
emanating the warmth.
It's exactly that. It's exactly that. So we do what we call the brag sheet, but it's really just a bio for everybody that's been on. And so I'm going to read yours now. And I just got this right from the psych because we sort of had one. Our producer put one together, but yours is much more like eloquent. And so I'm just going to read it because it sums you up so well as it should. All right. The Wall Street Journal has called Moore vigorous, cheerful, and fiercely articulate. Three things I've never been accused of. He was named in 2017 to Politico Magazine's list of top 50 influence makers in Washington and has been profiled by such publications as New York Times, Washington Post, Time Magazine, and New Yorker. An ordained Baptist minister, Moore served previously as president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and before that, as the chief academic officer and dean of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, We also taught theology and ethics. This already, two paragraphs, feels substantial, but there's more. There is more. Oh, that was a pun. Moore was a fellow at the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics and currently serves on the board of the Beckett Law and as a senior fellow with the Trinity Forum in Washington, D.C., hosts a weekly podcast. Hosts the weekly podcast, that's Russell Moore Show. And his co-host, that's right, of Christianity Today's weekly news and analysis podcast, The Bulletin. Russell was president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention from 2013 to 21. Prior to that, he served as provost and dean of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, where he also taught theology and ethics. A native Mississippian, which that makes two of us, I hope you know.
RM. I did know that, yeah.
That's me and you. Where are you from?
Biloxi.
Come on, man. Get out of there.
What about you?
Kosciuszko.
Oh, I know Kosciuszko.
Okay, respect. Yeah. He and his wife, Maria, are the parents of five sons. They live in Nashville, where he teaches Bible regularly at their congregation, Emmanuel Church. We are so happy to have you on. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How do you feel when you hear all that stuff?
I just kind of zone it out a little bit.
You were checking email. I get to know.
That's right.
All right. But what's the motivation for zoning it out? Are you zoning it out because it embarrasses you? Or are you zoning it out because you're like, if I get too close to that, you know, it might be dicey for the ego? What's going on?
No, it's not as self-conscious as that. I think I just zone out. Yeah. Maybe my subconscious does that. I'm not sure.
Yeah. The things that I'm going to tack on at the end of this that Andrew informed me of, loves old country music,
mm-hmm.
Batman comic books, which is awesome, and his family has to hide. This is maybe one of my favorite facts I've ever heard from a Dadville guest, and I quote, direct from AP, and his family has to hide the sweets in his house because he sleepwalks and eats it all if he can find it.
I sure can.
Okay, yeah. Now immediately when I hear that, I'm just going to say, another thing I'm owning up to, I'm like, are we putting sleepwalking quotes?
No, it really is. It
really
is. The
story you're sticking to?
It really is true. And I've had to tell people if I go somewhere, please don't put a gift basket in the room with me because I woke up in the morning and looked around, where are these chocolate shavings coming from? And it's all gone.
No
so
way.
So is that, do you think that is something on a subconscious level that you're like, let's say, you know, you're staying at the hotel after a speaking event, they give you a sweet little bag of sweets and your brain goes, okay, duly noted in
yeah,
my
oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly what happens. And that's what happens when if the kids bring in like Cool Ranch Doritos or something and I
like that
note that
savory.
It's there, then I will say, hide that. Yeah. And if you kind of see me, because you can't really tell when I'm sleepwalking, I seem like I'm kind of awake.
Yeah.
And I said, no matter what I say to you, don't. So it's like the werewolf that, you know, right. chains himself to the radiator at the full moon.
Yes.
Have you ever like woken up in a hotel room and you just feel terrible because the thing that you thought were sweets were actually like tiny little soaps or something like that?
No, that hasn't happened. But I did. I got my kids one time these chocolate dinosaurs. I still remember it even though it's been a long time ago. Chocolate dinosaurs in Chicago. And I woke up the next morning thinking that something was wrong, that I was bleeding, like there was blood all over me. And then I got up and realized, oh, it's chocolate. And I had eaten all of them, five chocolate dinosaurs, just gone. No memory of it at all.
Oh,
had to go.
It was the blood of the chocolate dinosaurs
kind
of on
right.
you.
Yeah, you're true. Right.
It really is. I mean, I'm kind of in awe of the power of your subconscious. It's a formidable thing.
It is. Yeah. It really. They know we're going to hide this from sleeping dad.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just what they say all the time.
Have you found the community out there to support you? Are there more?
I've met a couple other people who have similar thing, but that's it.
Love that. There's like some Facebook group where you guys just all like really commiserate. But except one is like, you know, it has to do with like cars, which is just wildly more dangerous.
No, it makes you think like, what are the other things? There could be so many other more useful things. Like you rake leaves in your sleep.
Yeah.
You wake up and the yard looks immaculate.
But it could be worse, too. It could be like alcohol or something. I could be clearing out mini bars.
And in your waking moments, you're like dry. You're so dry. And then like in your non-lucid moments, you're just like this drunkard. That is amazing. There's a few things that we're excited to sort of like bounce around here with you. I think the thing that's so fun about you, Russell, that's really tricky is you have so many fingers in so many things. You know, it's one of the things that I think is so fascinating about you is you're not this just kind of like, oh, you know, he does this thing or he's written these books in the sim, but you really do. You're so rounded. And so as John and I were talking about this episode, I was like, gosh, there's just a million things that I want to talk about. But I think probably the easiest jump in for me, because as I was Instagram, like stalking you, I found that every picture, it's so funny because, again, it just speaks to how wonderfully random your life is. It's like each slide next to the other sort of has nothing to do with
nothing
the one
to do
before.
With each other, no.
Do you know what I mean? Which is really impressive. And I really mean that. But the picture of you.
Or ADHD, maybe.
Well, touche. potato, patata. But the picture of you with Biden and Obama, is that in the Oval Office?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you – I don't know that we've had anybody on that – John, have we had anybody on that? Oh, probably Michael Ware has been in there, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. But other than Michael, I mean, I don't know anybody that's been in that room. Do you feel like when you walk in there, do you feel that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Although, I mean, the first time I ever walked in the Oval Office, the first thing that I thought was.
I love that you said first time, but that was a wonderful flex.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, this is nothing like the West Wing or any other, because almost every television or film depiction of the Oval Office has it really dark, you know, with these.
Oh, wow.
And that's not at all. Not at all what it's like. But President Obama used to keep a bunch of, and I still don't know why, but would keep this big basket of apples in the table right there. And I used to always wonder, has anybody ever just reached over and started eating one of these apples? I mean, what is the story? And I still don't know.
I would love it if, like, your description, every question we ask you, you're just talking about the candy that was in the room.
That's true.
And I noticed there was a bag of Rolos just at the, right behind the desk.
And that's you looked at them and you said, listen, guys, no matter what happens, do not let me fall asleep. Do not let me fall asleep.
So what was the, was that a meeting that you guys were having, or how long were you in there?
For that picture?
For that particular time.
Yeah, we were meeting about something. I mean, we would... That one might have been on refugees, immigration reform, or it might have been criminal justice. I'm not sure which that particular
this
one
is again was. What's so impressive about you, because I mean, it's like you have to reference which time and the reason why, which is surely you recognize how cool that is, right?
I don't know. It's
so you just blacked out again. I could tell. Yeah. You just like any compliment
when you step into the Oval Office. That let's say the last time. Uh-huh. Is it still, I mean, you've been there multiple times. Are you at the point where it's just another meeting or is it not lost on you?
It's always an impressive thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you ever like just slightly tempted to try to steal like a pencil or something? Just something small.
No,
you blacked over again. I can see your eyes. You did that thing. And no, you're not genuine.
Well, one of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about, and I, you know, I want to be upfront and say, this is not a political talk here, and I'm not interested in talking about your politics, a left or right, or any of that kind of stuff. But I, you know, in 2016, when you were one of the voices of being critical of then nominee Trump. I'm just curious what was your headspace before you kind of made some public statements, and B, what was your experience post that? Because obviously you got a lot of attention, you got a lot of backlash, and what was that whole experience like for you?
Well, I think there are some people who think that I didn't know what the response would be. And yep. I knew exactly what the response would be. But I felt like I had to had to do that and say that. I say that like it's past tense. I feel like I have to do that and say
that. Yeah, well said.
But the first time in 2015, I knew what was going to happen, but I felt like this I just don't have a choice here. Mm-hmm. And that was I mean, it was an excruciating several years on on many fronts, not just on that front, but on many fronts. Mm-hmm. And it also is an unusual presidency in the sense that, well, in all kinds of ways, but in one sense, because usually when somebody there's somebody who's kind of opposed you, what you kind of usually want to do is to win that person over and reassure them I'm really not the person you think I am or that kind of thing. And that wasn't the way it went, really.
Wow.
So that part was a little surprising, yeah.
Do you feel like being someone who has been so active in all the causes that you have been championing for so long, you know, this was, you know, back in 2015, 2016, I'm sure you could give many more examples like that where you have gotten in the mix, you know? Mm-hmm. Do you notice a change in sort of, very broadly speaking, our capacity for like useful dialogue and discourse? Do you feel like that's being chipped away at?
Yeah. I mean, and one of the reasons I think it's being chipped away is because, you know, one of the things that we used to always say in terms of getting a coalition of people together, because one of the things I've done all my life is to work in issues where a lot of times I'm working with people, we don't agree on anything else. We just agree on this. We just agree on human trafficking or refugee resettlement or something like that. And so this is the only thing we agree on, and we can agree on that together. And usually what I've found is if you can take an issue that hasn't been sort of colonized by politics and culture wars and all that, and work together on it, then usually you can sort of build out from there. You start to see, okay, wait a minute, this person isn't the devil, and maybe there are some other ways that we can work together. Problem is now there are so few of those issues, because almost immediately any issue that even comes up is going to be tribalized. Right. And it's very, very hard to find issues that don't.
Man,
Dave, I want to give a shout out. Yeah. And when I give a shout out, I always laugh because it just brings me so much joy to give a shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with free samples.
You know it, John. This time of year, my allergies are in fuego. They're always on the attack, but I use this and you should too.
Oh, I do, Dave. Every day in our house. Yeah. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D.
Designed for serious allergy sufferers, which is me raising my hand, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill to relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better.
This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, and itchy nose and throat and sinus congestion and pressure with ease.
John, I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for a long time, and it's been an absolute life changer. I can go for a run without my eyes watering. I may be crying, but it's not from allergies.
Totally different.
And I can sing without feeling like I have like a big old, let's not even call it a frog. It's like a toad.
It's like a family of toads.
It's a turtle.
Yeah.
In my throat.
So, you ready to live life as if you don't have allergies?
Yeah, me.
It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter.
Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed. John, Tag, you're supposed to run after me after I touch you. You can't. That's not
That's not how tag works, the way you're
playing. It's a regional thing. I'm playing Midwestern rules.
Oh, I should have known that. Okay, yeah. My bad. Yeah. Sorry.
Hey, speaking of, Dave, you know, with Memorial Day coming up,
I'm guessing you're
probably getting ready for plenty of fun days in the sun.
Oh, my gosh.
Am I right?
First, I have to learn these rules for tag. But yes, everyone knows this, John. Everyone knows that time in the sun is best enjoyed with a pair of shades that you don't have to baby.
Oh, yeah.
Knockaround is the original affordable sunglasses company, and they've got just what you need for Memorial Day weekend, MDW, for those of us who celebrate all year, and all the way through summertime.
They do. And with over 20 different frame styles, there's something for the whole family, including tons for kids.
So, whether you're looking to rock a pair of red, white, and blue shades for the big weekend, or just to restock your collection before summer gets here, Knockaround has you covered.
Now, Dave.
Yeah.
Did you know that all their lenses have UV 400 protection, which is basically like sunscreen for your eyeballs?
Oh, man. And I've put copper tone just right on the old ojos, and it burns. It is not burning pretty. Still to this day.
Yeah, well, you keep putting it on.
Well, it's a habit. With polarized adult pairs starting at $28, you can get a few pairs to leave in your car, toss in your beach bag, or lend to a friend in need.
You know, Dave, where I come from, Memorial Day weekend means it's race day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and
oh,
there's no more important place to have some shades than outside at the track.
Oh, yeah.
If you've heard me say that once, you've heard me say that a million
times. It's on your front yard.
I think I might actually just buy a pair of knockarounds in that color.
Yeah.
Like in the color of each car, actually.
Yeah.
And it's switching back and forth based on who's leading the race.
Love that. That's one of the best ideas you've ever had. That's
yeah. So listen, Dadville fans, take that idea and run with it. Also, don't be the one squinting through family beach days or trips to the park. Go to knockaround.com and use the promo code DADVILLE15 for 15% off your order.
That's DADVILLE15 for 15% off your order at knockaround.com.
I just said that.
Because I could see with that background that you just talked about, I could see how you would have a more optimistic view on our country right now, because you're like, you know, I'm actually one of the guys that's in these rooms that people don't even think exist anymore, where it's like, no, these conversations can happen. Do you feel like you have, are you optimistic about the future?
You know, if you're looking for somebody optimistic about the future, I'm probably not the person right now. I might be, you know, I come up and down, and I may be different about it later. I've got a long-term optimism, but I'm really nervous about the about the next 5 to 10 years. I am really nervous.
And how does that iterate in a way that, like, what makes you nervous about that? Like, how does that play out?
Well, I mean, we're at a really crazy, dysfunctional, angry, resentful, fearful time. And we're also at a point where we've become numb to so much. Things that would have at one point been, just have dominated everything in shock, or now we just move on from it. And so that is happening at the same time that I think there were a lot of people who had this idea, well, yeah, we're in a crazy time, but, you know, that's happened before, and there'll be something that fixes it. So there'll be a lot of people would think, well, there'd be a big national emergency, like September 11th, and the country will all rally around. We had a big national emergency, and that didn't happen. Yeah. So that's kind of why I'm not.
Yeah.
Now here's where I am. Where I am sort of optimistic about this is that I'm with 20 somethings all the time on college campuses and university campuses, and I would have thought that, you know, a lot of these people have all of their high school years were growing up in crazy America the way we've been for the last little bit. And so I think I might have assumed that most of them would have just adapted to it all. And I don't see that. Especially among, in general, among 20-something. So I'm optimistic about that.
Because I am always curious, you know, like every generation, it feels like, it's the world's going to hell in a handbasket, you know? So there is always, like, you know, I'm 41 now, and I'm like, do I just feel the way my dad felt at 41? And this, right. and, And I'm hoping, you know, you want the answer to be, yeah, everything's going to be fine. Just everybody feels this way. Nothing's unique, you know, all that kind of stuff. But
yeah, and that was a question that I spent a lot of time pursuing, because I would talk to experts, in, you know, historians, sociologists, psychologists, everything you could imagine. And that has been the question I would always ask, which is, are things as crazy as they seem?
Wow.
Or is this just life and you don't really notice it until a certain point? And uniformly, I mean, without one exception, the answer has been, and without any hesitation, no, this is different. Because we're in, there's a difference that comes with, and there are all kinds of factors to it, but almost everybody will identify a social media atmosphere and the things that then come after social media as being what's distinct.
Yeah, that's well said.
And so it's kind of Gutenberg, the difference that's happening here. So, because I would always say, I would have in mind the thought that you just had. Well, everybody, you know, every generation, people think, oh, things are really going crazy. But also there's a situation you can look back at times, every time that is really, really crazy, dangerous in world history, people were thinking, it's life, something will happen. So, you know, so it works both ways.
Well, it does seem like, you know, the examples that I go back to kind of make myself feel better is like, you know, if you grew up in the, you know, I don't like in the 40s and then, you know, lived 41 years, like the amount of things that happened, like in World War II and all the wars and the assassinations and Martin Luther King, all this stuff, there's a lot of crazy, really huge events that have happened. But I do think, to your point, it does seem like what's unique now is our inability to kind of come together, you know, our discourse with each other is just worse than it's ever been.
To your point, Russell, it's like, I think so much about the social media has given everybody a microphone and a megaphone, really. Like literally every human that wants one suddenly can have really pronounced thoughts, whether they have actually wisdom or knowledge about those thoughts. And
and you also, when you have people who are lonely and disconnected, and most of America right now is lonely and disconnected.
Wow.
Nobody actually stays that way. You can't live that way completely isolated. So what a person wants to do is to try to find a semblance of community. And they usually are finding it online somewhere. And then you have this sort of, you have this tribe of people that you're not ever with in regular life about anything that doesn't have to do with whatever it is that's bringing you all together. And so to remain part of that tribe, you have to parrot back what it is to be in that tribe. And so the very act of proving that you belong leads to more and more extremism. And that's a lot of what's happening right now. There are not people don't have parts of their lives that are separate from whatever is right in front of them in social media. And then the other thing is, I mean, there was a study done several years ago about if you look at these social media platforms, look at X, formerly known as Twitter. Most people on that platform, this study showed, are actually normies. They just don't post or they don't stay, because you have the sort of mobs that come on there and the trolls that come on there, and that's incentivized, and the normies leave. Now, that wouldn't really matter if it were about just social media platforms, but that's what's happening in churches and neighborhoods and families and other places. And so it creates more of the loneliness, which then creates people have to have another hit to try to make it better, and they go back to the...
It's I've talked about this, that I'm beating a dead horse bit, but I think I said this a couple weeks ago on one of these podcasts, but I think one of the things that I keep learning the older I get is that the plan of the church by God is such a genius move, because in making us, we're meant to be communal things, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the danger, there's just such a tremendous danger when we cut ourselves off from community. And I think one of the millions of reasons that it's so wise is what you just said, that idea that like, when we get too much distance, you can start to reframe and make up stories and these things that literally just sitting with a human being can change. Just physically seeing somebody, because all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, that's like a guy with kids and, mm-hmm. you know, who likes pizza. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like mm-hmm. it changes from this sort of thing we cook up in our brains. And so I think one of the most genius things that God did in making us was going, hey, that you need to be together. Like there's a million reasons for it, but one of them is what I think you're saying, is this thing that loneliness really does create these crazy, lives we live in by ourselves and make up all these rules and things about people that just being around people can almost single-handedly eradicate, or at least really give some friction to your thoughts on those things.
Yeah, you know? And you need to be needed. And I mean, I think of Wendell Berry was talking one time about his community and why it actually wasn't as polarized as a lot of places. And he said, it's because we're a really small community. We're way away from everything and we need each other. Wow. And so you have to have a kind of prepaid forgiveness in that kind of a world. And that's really true everywhere. It's just that's you can so notice it in that situation.
That's beautiful. That's really sad. How have you navigated? I mean, to your point about being, you know, like John said, with the last election and you being in that political space, so much being in the Christian space, like how, like I look at your career and your life and I feel like personally, you've done a really good job of navigating that. Like, I feel like, Well, I do, you know, I think, well, but like, how have you done, like, what is that like to do that? How have you walked that line? I mean, you know, I'm sure it can't be, especially like you said, it's not like it's gone away, you know, some of even from 16 or whatever, you know, I'm sure you're still dealing with a lot of backlash from that even now, but I mean, how do you walk that like you do?
Well, I mean, it's not so much, backlash from that as, I mean, it's ongoing. And so, you know, it's an ongoing situation and we're not,
it's just lash.
It's just lash. You know, I think part of it is I hate, conflict.
Wow.
I actually hate controversy.
You could have picked a different path there.
Yeah, I know. I have friends who really do actually enjoy, not because they're pugnacious or quarrelsome people, but just sort of gets their blood flowing. I'm not that way. I don't mm-hmm. like it at all, really. But I also know that, you know, I was a 15-year-old who was going through a deep spiritual crisis, wondering, is all this just a game? Hmm. And is all this really just about something else? And what helped me through that is the fact that there were people who were models from a distance that I was able to say, okay, well, that is a way of being. Hmm. That at least gave my imagination something to consider and something to look at. And so I'm constantly thinking about the 15-year-old people, you know, whatever age they are, who are going through that similar situation. And in order to say, you're not crazy. And this isn't the way for everybody necessarily, but it is a way. And I think the problem is there are a lot of people who think they have to choose between false alternatives. And so you end up with a bunch of either ors where there really are both ands. And you have a lot of both ands that are present where there really should be an either or.
Yeah.
And that's all of that's mm-hmm. confused. And so that's kind of what I'm what I'm trying.
Dave, John, we all love summer, and our kids especially love summer, but we lose that consistent schedule of when kids are in school, and that can create some summer childcare problems.
You know what? Thankfully, though, Dave, there's a solution.
What?
Windy. That's W-Y-N-D-Y. Listen, it's an app that connects families to college student nannies literally in minutes. These nannies are background checked, interviewed, and honestly, Just awesome, Dave.
That's right, John. And Wendy has been around for 7 years and has been used by over 20,000 families. There are hundreds of qualified college student nannies on Wendy near you, working full or part-time.
All you have to do is go to wendy.com/dadville to start searching for a nanny. And as a special offer, they're going to knock off $50 off your search.
Yeah.
If you go through that link. Wendy provides top-notch service, but at a fraction of the cost of traditional nanny agencies.
Ooh.
And no ongoing fees.
Okay, so here's how it works. Go to wendy.com/dadville to start your search. A Wendy concierge will find great matches for your job and set up interviews for you. You can choose the one you like.
Get started now, because there are a lot of parents out there looking for nannies for the summer.
That's right.
Go to wyndy.com/dadville.
Hello, Dave. Wow.
Okay, yours was better than mine. Johnny.
Thanks.
Are you loving this warmer weather? Summer is just around the corner.
Dave, I am so glad that you brought that up, because the weather has been so great. Mm. I'm playing tennis, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting outside on the porch
in
my tennis shoes, going for walks in different shoes. I don't walk in tennis shoes. Yeah, I mean, it's so nice. And honestly, I don't really want to be spending too much time in the kitchen making meals, because there's so many other good things
John,
to do
John,
outside.
John. That's where Factor comes in. You can fuel up with Factor's no prep, no mess meals, so you can spend more time outside.
Okay, it sounds good, but Dave, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Can I meet my wellness goals in time for summer with Factor?
I hope you've got goals and then more goals, John, because we'd call you Cristiano Ronaldo. Soccer joke.
Heyo.
And guess what? And then some, John. It's going to be just fine. Factor has chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. And Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are dietitian-approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Dave, that sounds so awesome. You've talked me into it. I'm ready.
Wow, that was easy.
I'm ready to kickstart my routine with 35 different
Good
meals.
Gracious.
And more than 60 add-ons to choose from,
Goodness
Dave. Did you know
gracious.
That? I'm educating you now. And these are restaurant-quality meals like filet mignon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shrimp,
mm-hmm.
blackened salmon.
Enjoy
you know?
Effortless support for your lifestyle. Choose from 6 menu preferences to help you manage calories, maximize protein intake, avoid meat, or simply eat well-balanced.
Head to factormeals.com/dadville50 and use the code dadville50 to get 50% off. That's 50, 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month.
That's code DADVILLE50 at factormeals.com/DADVILLE50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
Do you feel a pressure from knowing that you're kind of one of the, I think about Tim Keller in this way, but like, you know, one of those people that it feels like the world has sort of gone, okay, you're going to be somebody we... you know, CNN calls to get the Christian perspective on that. I mean, does that come with sort of a baked in pressure, or like, do you feel that, or is that liberating and exciting?
Yeah.
Or,
there's a pressure to it, but what I'm always having to sort of remind myself of are the overhearers. That's really who I'm talking to, all the time. It is not so much the people who are right in front of me, but the people who are overhearing. So, for instance, usually when you have somebody out there who's completely disconnected from any religious connection, but they're starting to be interested in it or starting to ask those questions, they usually don't say anything to anybody about it. And as a matter of fact, they usually kind of argue more vigorously. We're trying to protect ourselves, and so we argue more vigorously from something that's going away in us, and that can work the other way too. So those people often are overhearing and trying to listen and to say, what is Christianity? And at the same time, I know there are a lot of Christians who are overhearing to say, some of them to say, can I really be a Christian? Some other people who are saying, because everybody's got to do you know, I had somebody say one time, how what kind of pressure is it to be, you know, talking to Anderson Cooper or Jake Tapper or somebody like that about these? I said, well, everybody really has to do that. I mean, you have to talk to people who don't share the same religious faith that you do. You have to do that. Everybody has to do that. Unless they're just completely enfolded in some sort of a sheltered world. We all have to do that. So it's for people who are overhearing to say, okay, what are some possible ways that I could think about doing that? Even if they say, well, I don't want to do it that way, I'm going to do it a different way. But it puts the process of thinking it in their mind, I think.
Yeah, that's...
What do you think of, you know, obviously many, many people are going to hear your statements on something if you write an article or you get on CNN and you're talking to them. Whatever you say, there are many, many people who are like, this guy's representing a whole group of people. And I think that's always an interesting situation to be in. And I'm always curious about that person, how they view about that. Like, is that fair that we ever put that on anyone? Because you can really only speak for yourself. This is, these are your thoughts on any given subject, but you must know that that's why they have you on, you know, because you are giving the thoughts on whatever X subject from this perspective, you know. Do you, how do you feel, what's your relationship like with that? Do you think that's fair that that's put on you?
I don't really think that that's put on me because if you look at, say, secular America, most of the voices that they are hearing from a full-bore Christian perspective usually almost always fit in one category. And so I'm usually the person who is saying, actually, there's another way to think about this also. Yeah. And so it's not, I'm never in a situation where I think, okay, I'm the only, picture of evangelical Christianity that anyone's going to see. As a matter of fact, it's usually the opposite. I'm worried about people who only see one version of evangelical Christianity and assume, if I say no to that, that means that I have to say no to Jesus. And I don't think that's the right choice.
I can't imagine with your, you know, like John brought up a while ago, the stance you took with Trump. I can't imagine how obviously hard that's been, but also I would imagine it opened a copious amount of doors for people who were like, wait a second, what? Like, I thought I knew what this was and it counted y'all out. And all of a sudden they're like, okay, well, let's engage in conversation because I didn't know we could even have that conversation.
Absolutely. And that causes, find myself in situations where people are asking me about the gospel and the Bible who were never interested in the gospel and the Bible before.
But who
are able to say, but wait a minute, why are there people who believe this stuff, but who don't? And the same thing, it's not just with the political stuff, but with the scandals that we've seen over the past several years and all of those kinds of things. I was teaching on a very, very secular college campus for a semester a year or two ago. And my students were all, I mean, virtually without exception, all sort of agnostic atheists, but who had never really even thought about it and had never been around a religious person before.
Wow.
And what, I mean, I was probably the first evangelical Christian any of them had ever met.
Wow.
And what they wanted to ask about were all theological questions. I mean, it was problem of evil. It was, how does a person have a relationship with God? It was all of those kinds of things because it was strange enough for them that it didn't feel like they were inviting. I mean, there's a certain kind of cultural context where if you ask somebody about their faith, it's kind of like finding the Amway salesman and saying, "Hey, do you know anything about products?" And you're right, kind of right. So they weren't even, that wasn't on their mindset. It was just, wait a minute, you actually think this dead guy came back to life?
Yeah.
So
those are such invigorating conversations. Yeah. Like, we have a friend who grew up in England, and she's a dear friend of ours, and we have the most fascinating conversations about God because she has no context for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes for such wonderful, like, non-biased takes. You know, it's one of my favorite conversations to have. So being married, if a new married couple sat down with you, you've married 30 years, 5 kids, and said, "What do we need to know?" What do you think you would say to them?
I mean, one of the things I do say to them is if I'm taking a couple through,
do you do premarital counseling?
Yeah. If I'm taking a couple through premarital counseling, a couple things that I do, one of them is to say, what I want you to do is to do this homework assignment completely separately, and come in and bring it with you, where what you're answering is, if I were going to have an affair, here's how I think I would go about hiding it.
Whoa.
And here are the sorts of things you should do to look into it. The reason I do that is not because nobody knows exactly what they would do.
Right.
But it the initial response is always, "Oh, I would never cheat on her. I would never cheat on him. He's my soulmate." And
you're like, guess what I'd never do? Eat a bunch of chocolate.
Dinosaurs, that's right. But what I'm trying to do is to show them from the very beginning, you have vulnerability that you need to be working on.
Wow.
And the other thing is to say to them, you really need to be working through problems in the really, really good moments. And nobody wants to do that, because you don't want to sort of, disrupt a nice dinner together but that's actually the time, not when you're in the middle of some sort of a fight with each other. That's the time to say, when you say you're acting just like your mother, here's how I respond to that. Something like that, where the temperature's way down. Mm-hmm. And that would be one thing. And then the other thing that it probably isn't good for everybody, but it's worked for us, is I don't think we ever talked about this. We just kind of did it. Somebody's always the stable one, at any point. And sometimes one of us will kind of be sort of falling apart a little bit, and then see the other one and say, "Oh, wait, it's your turn." You just kind of kick into this this more chill mode, and that's worked.
Oh yeah.
So this year will be 30 years for you guys. Is that right?
Yeah, this May.
Yeah. So I imagine this is a very tough question to answer, but I mean, looking back through 30 years, can you kind of see an arc of how your marriage has changed?
Not really. I mean, I think our marriage is the same now as it was in 1994 in all kinds of ways, except that it's deeper. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, one of the things I think about all the time is, and I will say, I'll see people who, are divorced and they're marrying somebody else my age, and I'll think, I don't know what I would do without the shared history and the shared stories. I mean, even apart from everything else, having been through so much together, to be able to just talk about things with a kind of shorthand, we both know what we're talking about.
Right. Yeah.
That would be a huge loss. And I can't imagine starting that all over again. So there's this whole sort of infrastructure underneath that we don't really think about a lot or talk about a lot, but it's all there, and it shapes and forms who we are. And that's just a big part of it. And it's not something that's really examined often. And I find one of the problems that I tend to have, and there'll be these moments where I'll kind of break through, is that I kind of take things for granted. And then there'll be these moments, like at Christmas this year, all of my sons were around the table, and Maria was there at the table, and I was sitting there, and just for a second, it was like I was outside of myself, kind of looking in as an observer, and was thinking, you know, there was a time when they told us we would never have children, and I was anguished in praying for children, and look, and I take it for granted. And if my 27-year-old self could see this scene, he would have said, okay, I don't care about anything else. That's enough. And so sometimes that'll break through.
So you have five boys, is that right? What's the age range there?
From 22 to 12.
Okay, 22 to 12. So you guys are still in the thick of it a little bit.
We have two high schoolers and a middle schooler now, about to go into middle school.
And two are adopted, is that right? So what are your two. I know you have, you know, lots to say on this. What are maybe a couple things that you wish that people would know about adoption, or maybe some things that you have experienced that maybe you were surprised by that people might not know about that process?
I think there is a sense in which people don't know how difficult this is. And by people, I don't mean the people who are adopting. I mean usually the people who are around them. Who know that the process is difficult, but who really don't understand the unique kinds of parenting and all of those unique challenges that come with that in order to kind of help them and to shore that up. I think there are a lot of people who don't get that and who don't understand it really, even in the best of circumstances. It's very, very difficult, and you really need people around who understand there are certain parenting things that would work fine in normal circumstances, but wouldn't work here. And I think there are a lot of people who don't get that.
My guess would be one of the many, many things that you guys as parents would have to kind of navigate would be, you know, I have two daughters, and both of them, you know, as they have grown up, they're 8 and 11 now, like you see their little personalities and you see how, you know, you just get to know them, right? And with anyone who also has adopted children, they have a history, they have ties outside of this house, you know, outside of my wife and I, all that kind of stuff. And so you're sort of, I'm sure there are lots of families that might think, you know what, we're going to do the whole like sort of colorblind thing. We're like, we're ignoring that. They are part of this family, you know? And I think, I'm sure that works for a while, and then maybe that doesn't work, you know. And how do you navigate that specifically?
Well, I think one of the things is often what people assume is what's difficult for somebody is what the person remembers or is used to. And so a lot of people like us, I mean, we adopted our sons when they were a year old, and they don't remember anything about any of this, but there's so much that happens in that first year that means there needs to be a different kind of attention given. That's part of it. But the other part of it is children are unpredictable no matter how they come into the family. I mean, nobody is just a kind of mix of genes. And so, you know, I will talk to my wife a lot about, with all five of our sons, to say, you know, they're all basically who they were when they showed up. In the sense that if you had said to me, here's a description of each of your sons as teenagers or young adults, I would have been able to tell you who was who when they were born. So they're all the, and that means that you can't, I have one son who's really hard on himself and super disciplined and, you know, and I, most of what I do with him is to say, hey, just chill out, just relax, just don't be so hard on yourself. And I've got another son who's just very, kind and open, open-minded toward everything, who might tend to have a different problem, or I would have to give him and say, no, this is, you know, let's think about the more black and white here. And so you, that's the case really, regardless of how somebody, how a child comes into the family.
How with the five of them, how have you noticed, and has, there may not be a difference, but with your oldest child to your youngest, have you noticed any differences in your parenting between those two?
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of it is that with the first two, because we were adopting two kids at once, both with separate kinds of needs and issues. And they were our first kids, so we thought, well, this is just what parenting is. Oh, and so we plowed right into it and didn't think anything of it. When our first biological son came, we said to each other one day, this is so easy. Why do people complain about this? And we have said every time. So that of course was going to be a big difference.
Yeah.
But also, I think the thing I've learned the most about parenting is what to not freak out about. So there are a lot of things with the older kids where what you're freaking out about is not so much what's happening right there, but you think, oh, is this the beginning of something? You know, awful. And we've got to get it right now. And then as time goes on, you're just like, that's what seventh grade's like. You know?
Yeah, that's right. That's so true. That's so true. So there's a book been written, and I don't even know if you wrote it anymore at this point, but it's called Onward, Engaging
yes,
the
I
Culture.
That.
Okay, good. Just, this is me fact-checking without losing the gospel. I'm so curious about this. Like, how do you encourage your children in that way? Like, being people out, you know, out in the world that, as you said, is getting, it's just different. It's so, I mean, especially from, I feel like even I'm 45 and when I grew up, even feels so different. Like, how do you encourage them in engaging it? You know, and you said it so beautifully, especially when you have kids, like we all do, that are so different, you know, some that may be more open-minded, some that are really disciplined and, you know, in that book, like, how do you walk through doing that? Like, what are some of the ways you've engaged that with your children?
Well, I think most of it is not about sitting down and saying, okay, here's how you handle this and here's how you handle that. Most of it is about modeling a certain way toward the world. And so it's kind of similar. When I was teaching ethics in seminary context, you would have people who what they wanted was just give me the right answer. To human cloning and, you know, whatever, all the right answer, all these things. And what I was wanting to do instead was to teach them how to think about something and how to approach something, because the things that they were going to face are probably the things that nobody's thinking about right now. Yeah. And so a general, more general way of trying to walk through that. And so I think a lot of it is modeling, and then a lot of it is not being afraid to talk about stuff. So when something comes up, I think for a lot of, especially Christian parents, when a question comes up, sometimes there's a sense of, oh no, here's this issue. I'm not ready to talk about it. And I have to be right now. If I mess this up, I have messed up their entire lives. And that, you know, kids can read that. And what they can read is they're really scared. And so if having the ability to say, I don't know, is often a, I don't know, but let's try to think about it and figure it out. I mean, that's often the best answer.
Yeah. John and I laugh so much, by the way. I mean, like, because our kids' ages are there, I'm like, we are constantly living in the fear. Like, that was it. That was the one question.
That's
and now,
the question. Yeah,
you know, they're going to live in an alley and, you know, sell Beanie Babies for drugs. It's going to be a whole thing.
You know, you think about it in your own life, how much there are very little things. I lost my dad 3 years ago. there are very few things I can think of where my dad told me something and I'm holding on to it.
Wow.
There's a lot more where I'm thinking to myself, what would my dad have done in this situation?
Hmm. Wow.
And you've seen him in some other, and even when it's things where I wouldn't do it the same way, it helps you to find your own way.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So
yeah,
that's what I think is most important.
Yeah.
That is awesome. True. You know, I've never really thought about that in that specific context, like, thinking back on like how many are there any big issues that I'm like, well, no, I've felt this way on this topic for 30 years because my dad said something in 1993, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there are a couple of those, but they're all sort of like very trite things.
Yeah,
you know, like, oh, I didn't think we liked that restaurant, you know.
Right,
or whatever.
right.
But I don't know what it is about. I mean, I guess it's because our children are the most important things on the planet, and we just die without them. But we have parents snap to such a pessimistic outlook so often. You know, I think it's a common trend when we have guests on the podcast who have kids who are like out of the house and they're further down the road from us. It's always a more laid back, like you're saying, like, don't view everything through like, okay, this is a fork in the road. There's like two options here, right or wrong, and you got to get this right. I don't know why we so easily snap to like that worldview of parenting, you know?
Yeah, and I think it is because they're so important to us, and also because it's hard for us to notice those stages of development.
Yeah,
that's a great
idea. And you know, and even I'm pretty laid back with stuff, but I, my 18-year-old, was driving by himself to Cleveland to see a concert that he wanted to see. And this is what he wanted to do. And, you know, I let him, and then I was like, man, it's Cleveland.
So this is the third. So this is the one right in the middle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was, I don't know about Cleveland. And my wife said, you were literally running comms for a congressional campaign at that age.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah.
Not in Cleveland, sweetie.
Honey, we stayed way afar.
Yeah. I think it's hard to, you look and say, it's hard for you to realize, it's easy for you to realize when you're 19. Okay, I'm not a baby. And it's very hard for you to see that when you're the parent of a 19-year-old.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, would you have let your oldest son drive to Cleveland at 18?
No.
No.
No, I don't think so. No. I don't think
so. And your youngest will probably go next year.
He's living there. He just moved to Cleveland. He's never coming home.
Yeah.
One more question, then we buckle up for the lightning round, Russell, because it's a real doozy. We obviously have so many parents that listen on this podcast. And I know this is kind of a global question, but I'm sort of pandering to the pastor in you. Do you have, like, if you had encouragement for parents right now, you know, in this day and age, like, what's the word you would give those people listening of encouragement?
Well, I mean, I think I would say similar to what we've just said. Don't panic and don't waste your life with your kids in a constant crouch of anxiety. Mm. And I mean, there's a really important book coming out by a friend of mine in February or March, talking about why you have such a spike in anxiety among teenagers, young adults. And one of the key reasons is because you have anxious parents.
Yeah.
And you have anxious parents not because of some, you know, flaw in them, but because they're thinking, okay, I've got to get this right. And what if I don't get this right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you waste a lot of time in a counterproductive sort of way. And the other thing I would say is pay attention to who your kid is.
Hmm.
And that means that you're going to respond very differently to each one of them. I mean, I think I'm a completely different dad to each of my five sons.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? I love that. That's so good. Well, here we are, right at the light, just poised right at the precipice here of the lightning round. So Russell, buckle up. Here we go.
Okay. Here we go. All right.
I'll lead us all. Are you going or me, John?
Are you going? I feel like you need to ask this question.
Okay. Because I've already had a snap on the book. What is the book you haven't written but want to?
At one point, I would like to do a big Christian ethics at one point.
Oh, wow.
And at some point, I want to write a novel that I've kind of been working on.
I wondered about that.
Yeah.
When you mentioned Wendell Berry, I was like, oh, I know what that mm-hmm. means.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those seeds are there.
Yeah.
So I remember reading Jaber Crow crying.
Oh, man, Jaber Crow.
Crying at the end of that book.
Yeah.
Like it ruined me.
Yeah.
That's great.
So we've mentioned, I think at the top, that you're a Batman man.
Mm-hmm.
Fan.
Batman man. Batman man.
If you were going to be Robin.
I love this question.
To one of the Batmen, which Batman would you be Robin to?
Oh.
Which Batman? Oh, you mean one of the movie Batman?
Mm-hmm. See, he's already discredited.
Yeah, I've already discredited that. Yeah. I mean, the problem with that is I'm just not a movie person, and I tend to get disengaged with movies quite a bit.
Oh, look at you.
So my wife laughs that I watch movies 5 minutes at a time if I'm in control.
Oh yeah.
Five minutes at a time. And then I go on. But I mean, in terms of, I might say Michael Keaton because it would be fun to be with Michael Keaton.
No doubt, apart from Batman.
No doubt.
I'm with
He's
you
gonna have
that.
Some good. Well, all right. The next one, best Batman villain.
Best Batman villain, I would probably say Penguin.
Oh, tell me why. This is fascinating.
And is it just Penguin or is it Danny DeVito?
No, I'm not even thinking of Danny DeVito. But Penguin himself, I mean, I think he's an interesting backstory, really cold-blooded, not as chaotic as Joker, but chaotic enough. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really.
I love how
especially the way there's a writer, Tom King, the way mm-hmm. he writes Penguin is actually terrifying. And might be one of the scariest. Yeah.
That's so fascinating, yeah.
All right, favorite old country record.
Oh, record. You mean an entire set of songs? Oh, well, I'll tell you, this is not what I'm saying is the best, but it's the one that if I had to just have one, it would be. Mm-hmm. And that is, there was a live, I think it was American Storytellers is what it was, that VH1 or somebody did mm-hmm. years ago with Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson doing their songs and talking, you know, about their songs in between. And I love that album.
I mm-hmm. so miss that format.
I know.
Genius format that was. Because it was like, not only did you get the songs and the stories, but the arrangements were always so cool.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It wasn't the thing you're used to.
And especially with those two, because you have Johnny Cash, you know, sort of voice of God, gravity, and you know, Willie Nelson probably just come off of a weed-filled room, but it's very chill and relaxed, and it's a good combo.
Nice yin yang. Okay, a couple more. Most embarrassing speaking/guesting moment.
Oh, I don't know. There have been so many of them. you know, at one time I was speaking somewhere at a conference or convention or something, and I had my son Jonah, my fourth son. He was about 7, and he was traveling with me. And the person who introduced me said, was going through the bio, and they said, and he has his son Jonah with him, who he adopted when he was a year old. Well, Jonah's biological kid, and I just had to get up at the mic and say, you know, I normally don't. Do I correct this? Do I not? I said, you know, I normally don't correct bios, but I just don't want Jonah to sit there for an hour thinking, why didn't they tell me this backstory?
So. He's like, all of a sudden you have the new Penguin. He's like, that is hysterical. Yeah. What a great, quite a great moment.
All right, last question. If you wrote a book on being a dad, what would the title be?
What would the title be? Abba.
Love that. Jeez. Oh, great band, too. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
for
this
taking
was
time
so great.
Hanging with us. It's been great. Anything before we let you go? Anything you want to plug? You got anything coming out that people should know about or pay attention to?
Well, I would always like for people to become a member at Christianity Today, and they can do that.
Oh, there website. It is. Yes, yeah. Yes, that's so great. Well, thank you so much for being on. It's so fun being with you. And hopefully we'll see you on Nashville, you know?
Yeah.
Walking about.
That's right.
In the Batmobile. Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks. See ya.